If you're a graduate student, go into a lab and publish papers. They don't need to be high profile. They don't need to be anything. Just show that you're competent and you can show up every day and do work. When you're a postdoc, then yes, start formulating your special magical take on the whole entire world.
How did it feel to get to know that you had a faculty job?
You're getting close to shedding tears now, Paul. It's very rare to work hard for something for 10 years, more than that, and then succeed. This is going to sound terrible, because if someone ever told me this, I would tell them to be quiet. But, you know, things are going to be okay. But that's the truth.
Yeah. Did you have kids at the right time?
This is Brain Inspired.
Warning, warning. This is a special episode. Hello, everyone. It's Paul, and I originally intended to release this episode only to my Patreon supporters on the private podcast feed that they have, where they now will be getting bonus podcast episodes. The nature of those extra episodes will be like this one, so it made sense to release this publicly so you'll know what kind of episodes Patreon supporters will be getting more of. Basically, many of these bonus episodes will focus more on the experience and insights of people in their academic and or industry careers. For this first one, I roped in my friend and former colleague from graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh, Patrick Mayo. Patrick is just starting his faculty position back at the University of Pittsburgh, where he'll continue researching how eye movements and vision work in non-human primates. So, if you listen to the podcast for the deeper science discussions, this episode is likely not for you, although we do talk about some of the bigger picture questions. The majority of the time, we talk about his experiences and his recommendations to those who may be thinking of pursuing a similar path. You can follow Patrick on his fresh new Twitter account, @Mayo_lab. And you can find show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/71. And if you do like this kind of episode and you'd like to support the show on Patreon, go to braininspired.co and click on the Patreon button there. I have a lot of great guests coming up with the normal types of episodes, and I'll continue releasing episodes like this to my Patreon supporters moving forward. As a side note, while Patrick and I spoke, he had in his background an old picture of me from graduate school days, my younger static head perched right next to his live, modern, moving head. So that was very distracting. Anyway, I love this man, and I hope you enjoy our chat. Patrick, thanks for doing this with me. Thanks for being my first guinea pig here.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations. I don't think I formally have said congratulations to you for getting a real job. You've made it.
Yeah, it's, you know, after 15 years of work, you finally get the job that you should have had 5 or 10 years ago.
Always the optimist. So yeah. I'm looking at your lab page at the University of Pittsburgh, and it says that you run, well, the name of your lab is the Visual Motor Neuroscience Laboratory. Is that the official name?
That's basically required by the department to come up with a name. So I wasn't in love with it, but it suffices.
Yeah. I mean, you've officially started, and I thought you had already moved to Pittsburgh, but you're speaking from your home near Duke.
Right. So still, it's sort of a weird circumstances of, well, this was all even before the pandemic, weird circumstances, finishing up my postdoc for basically another 1 or 2 months and then moving up to Pittsburgh after that, but doing work for both. So it's, yeah, that was not going to be easy to begin with. And then watching your children at home during the day
yeah,
makes it a challenging time, but you know, so it goes.
I never do this. I never ask my guests to describe what they do, but you want to just briefly describe what the vision is for your lab. And you don't have to go through like your entire history of science or anything.
So when I was 1 year old, I started thinking about,
someone removed the oxygen from your vicinity.
Right. And I thought, I can't see what's going on. No, I think in general, my lab studies the interaction of vision and eye movements is the simplest way to think about it. This is a something that I think is fundamental to understanding vision generally. I think it's...
The eye movement aspect?
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, I don't... Not to put too strong of a point on it, but to study vision without studying eye movements is not really studying vision, in my mind.
Okay.
I mean, that is putting a strong point on it. But, you know, of course, every lab has to focus on different things. But if we really want to understand vision, you know, we move our eyes. And that's important.
So the entire ventral visual stream is for not studying it is a pointless endeavor?
No, I didn't quite say that. But,
I'm trying to make you say something controversial.
Trying to rile it up here. I do think the ventral dorsal stream segregation is, you know, a bit overblown. Like mm-hmm. those pathways are connected throughout. So, but anyway, yeah. So that's the general foundation, I think, is studying vision and eye movements in order to better understand vision, and also as a test bed and sort of as a foundation for understanding the interaction of perception and action generally. You know, this is the same thing that limb movement people are doing. I just think eye movements are a bit better constrained, and obviously you only have fewer degrees of freedom than all the crazy things that you can do with your shoulder, elbow, wrist, etc.
Yeah, reaching is scary. It's always been scary. I mean, that's one of the nice things about eye movements, I suppose. Is your question then, is your quest to understand vision, would you say?
I think my quest, it's when you phrase it in that way, it makes me think of people who study primary visual cortex only and are like trying to do this hardcore, I'm going to study every 1 degree receptive field in V1 and come up with a model, and that is going to be vision.
I wish Matt Smith was here.
I know. Well, this is not an uncommon thought, right? And even I review papers for whatever journals, and they have models of vision, and they're really models of V1, which is great because we understand primary visual cortex, but you know, there's other parts of the brain, so I hear. And so I think I would like to understand the interaction of eye movements and vision. I think that's the dynamic, the richness of that behavior, you know, of what we're doing. That's actually vision when we're moving our eyes around and refocusing on things in the world. So I think that's more of the central question.
How does that differ from your original? I don't know if you had a crystal clear original question when you were getting into neuroscience, but are you like me and like everyone else that you wanted to solve consciousness and you know, understand what makes us conscious and all the highest level questions you could ask? Or was it always geared toward vision and understanding?
Well, if I can fill in your listeners, we obviously solved consciousness because you and I went to the consciousness conference.
That was a good year for consciousness science when we went, yeah.
And so I figured, why not wrap it up there and just move on to something else?
Right.
That was never my driving interest. I think I've been fortunate that I've been interested in a lot, if not most, of systems neuroscience level questions in the brain. Mm-hmm. It then comes down to, you know, what are my skills? What's my experiences like? And so right now, you know, I'm using the skills that I've acquired over the past X number of years and training in different labs to answer a question that I think is central to understanding the brain. And so it's not, it could be a different question. And actually, I really like and respect people who move around and follow, you know, what the next question is beyond, but that's where I am right now.
It's a really specific set of skills. I mean, you actually have developed a lot more broad set of skills than what I feel I got sort of pinned into. So, you know, we both studied monkey neurophysiology in our graduate school days, and I went on to do a postdoc where I was, you know, hoping to move beyond that. But then my skills were already so specialized and so valuable in that realm that you just kind of get pinned in and sucked into that one domain. And I really felt hemmed in. And I don't know if do you feel that way, or do you feel like you were unconstrained and could move on to do whatever you want to do?
Yeah. I did monkey electrophysiology even before I went to graduate school.
Yeah.
And that's sort of been the central thing that I've wanted to do, insofar as if you want to understand human vision, I'm a pretty big believer that that's a very good, if not the best model. And so the main way in which I felt hemmed in was as a senior postdoc, and you start to see the opportunities dwindling before your eyes, you start to think, I have all these skills, and they're very weird skills outside of academia, right?
Like, yeah.
I could go to the circus and train animals to do weird tricks, or I can just try to slog along in academia and try to get that faculty position sort of thing. So in terms of answering scientific questions, I never really felt that hemmed in. I mean, you're always limited in what your skills are, data analysis and modeling and all these different things. But to some extent, I think we're moving in science towards more collaborative efforts. And I think that helps bring in other skills that you individually might not have.
Yeah, that's exciting too. Just thinking about, for me, that's when I have the fear of missing out, you know, lack of an academic career for myself. One of the things that I realized that I'm missing out on is being able to set up a collaborative project and reach out to people. And so that's an exciting thing, I think. I mean, when I was a postdoc, I had behind me, I was at my desk, and behind me was a friend who did EEG work mostly in humans. And he was doing a little stint in a monkey neurophysiology lab to do EEG in monkeys and stuff. But, you know, he would get an idea for a project, write up the code real quick and spend about a week testing it out, and then maybe have a paper out of it. And it was really infuriating.
Yeah.
And he was doing it at the level of, you know, of psychology, where you really could ask just such a broad range of questions and apply it in such a broad, in, you know, so many different ways. And that's another thing where I felt like, well, I can do maybe three things within my little limited domain. And it's a shame, because it takes so much work to gain all of that knowledge and skill set. Now I'm just taking over the show here and complaining.
No. I think, I'm totally with you. And in fact, I think, but I do think there's reason for hope in the field generally. And that's, you know, the work that you and I did in graduate school is now vastly different using these sort of multi-contact electric probes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's insane. I've talked to the graduate students in my current lab now. It's like, you know, it took me a year to collect 100 neurons, right? Something like that. Maybe longer than that.
One per day. One per day was victory. Yeah.
I remember my average was if I got 3 per week, I was happy.
Yeah. Well, you have to overcome the technical hurdles and all the... yes,
right. And if you want, like, it has to be this type of neuron because it needs to be responsive in your task and all these things.
It has to stay alive for more than 30 minutes.
That's right. You have to not stab it, which is also a thing that you have to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, collecting that data now, I can start to see the ways forward for moving along the direction of what your colleague was doing, even in the field of awake behaving animals neurophysiology, which is you're recording. We certainly have the capability now to do online manipulations of the task. We have fast enough computers to do online analysis of the task. You just need the coding and the hardware to be set up correctly. But you can ask a question, record from a population of neurons, and answer that question in real time in the same day. That's technically possible. It's technically challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we're on the cusp of that. And that's cool, right? Like, no more of this, like, waiting around for a year to try to answer questions. And that's, you know, if we're doing science, that's what you want to be doing.
All right, let's back up and talk a little bit more about your job and your job search and life relative to work, and then we'll get back to some bigger science-y type questions. Mm-hmm. One of the main questions that I had from my listeners was about the two-body problem of one person and his or her spouse or significant other. In your case, you met Amanda, your wife, and you met her in graduate school, right?
Yep, same. She was in my same class, you know, the same year, show up on the first day of grad school to look at your fellow PhD classmates and meet them. And yeah.
And so,
I mean, you don't want to hear the love story part of it.
Well, I'll edit it out. We'll, okay.
It's fine.
So, fast forward, you guys got married and now you have two kids now. And I don't honestly remember how that worked out. How was it? I know that you guys had difficulties navigating the two-body problem, which is how to figure out who gets to do what they want to do and who has to go move to another city with the other person. So can you just kind of walk through how that worked out?
Yeah, of course. Well, we met in grad school. That was in Pittsburgh. And then we both wanted to do a postdoc. So we're relatively pragmatic people. And so the first thing was, well, where can we go? What city can we go to, you know, that fills whatever criteria we have in our personal lives that has enough labs that we can choose from?
Yeah.
You know, I can go through the list of cities. There's not that many, 3 or 5. We ended up going to Boston, which is the obvious answer.
What does she do? What was her specialty? Sure. So that people know? Sure. Because it's not like you're both monkey neurophysiology people.
That's right. She did, she's always done auditory neuroscience. In graduate school, she did sort of slice electrophysiology. She went on to do awake behaving recordings in mice in an auditory neuroscience lab in Boston. And so, you know, we were just looking at labs generally. Where are their auditory labs? Where are their vision labs? And that was sort of the basics of it.
Was it a necessary thing for you both to have do a postdoc at that point? Or did you have the conversation of, well, what if only one of us can get a job?
Yeah, at that point, that's what we both wanted to do. I think in the back of our minds, Amanda never was super enthusiastic about becoming a faculty member. That, you know, the difference in chores and work and job responsibilities was never a thing. She was never like, oh yeah, I want to sit and write grants. She's always lusted after the job that doesn't really exist, which is the senior staff scientist, you know, the glorified permanent postdoc.
There are a few of those. There were, and they're enviable, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, fellow Pitt alumni, Becky Berman and her husband are both staff scientists at NIH. And, you know, so they exist, but they're very rare.
They seem happy. They're a happy lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not those particular people, but the staff scientists that I've met, you know, kind of older often and have been doing it for a long time and just completely happy with their role and their life. So,
Yeah. I mean, for Amanda, that's, you know, she wants to do science every day and she's actually happy to have someone tell her or to consult with, like, here's the science we want to do. Like, she's fine with that, right? She doesn't need to have her own idea or her own project that, like, drives her personally.
And what is she doing today?
So after, I'll give the really brief recap. We both did our postdocs in Boston. You know, then it becomes, well, what are we going to do next? She decided she wants to do, leave academia and look into industry. She's now basically, she works for this company, Illumina, which if you're familiar with PCR and sort of, actually, if you're familiar with the stock market, it's supposedly a hot stock.
It's public?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, so they make, well, they do a whole bunch of things. You can look up Illumina.com. She actually helps curate rare and undiagnosed diseases from the perspective of these patients who get full genome sequencing. So she looks through the primary literature, and this is, I mean, it's pretty cool. It's sort of similar to what you're saying about your colleague at during your postdoc, which is, you know, there's doctors on the front lines who are trying to figure out, in short, what's wrong with this patient, right?
Yeah.
And they can't figure it out for a few reasons. One is because maybe only 3 other people in the history of the world have been diagnosed with this thing, and those papers have been published in the past 2 years. And, you know, when you're an MD, you're not going home and reading the primary research at night.
Yeah.
So Amanda works on a team that helps diagnose those sorts of issues and actually sees some tangible results, which is always a nice thing.
So you never faced you only faced the problem of both wanting to do a postdoc simultaneously. So you didn't really face the problem of a dual faculty search.
That's right. Although, I mean, I have to say, from everything that I've heard, dual faculty searches are slightly more of a pain, but they can actually help you in some ways.
I've seen that happen.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that with a bunch of people, actually.
Someone gets a job who might not otherwise have gotten that job, or a job is created for that person, et cetera. Yeah.
Yep. And they get a good position. I mean, you know, they get some resources. And I should say, it's also not always the case. You know, one of those people, one of the dual bodies is the more heavily recruited person. And I've also seen it after 5 years, the other person is the more successful one for the university.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Well, would you say that you guys are in a happy situation then? I mean, that it worked out as well as it could?
It absolutely has worked out in a ridiculously ideal way.
That's great.
I mean, insofar as Amanda's, you know, she works from home. that's always made us flexible in terms of moving anywhere. And going back to Pittsburgh, where I got my faculty position, is basically ideal.
Yeah, we didn't say that. So you went to graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh, and now you're back.
Yeah. Go Panthers.
Yeah, it's the Panthers.
Panthers, right?
Yeah, I believe that's right. Yeah.
I mean, Steelers, really, but Panthers.
Sure. Maybe is that it for the two-body problem? Did we miss anything important in that story?
Yeah, I mean, I should acknowledge she sacrificed a bit for me, right? Knowing that this is what I want to do, this is my passion, a bit more than her.
How so?
Because she took this position of working from home that, you know, she could have just as easily, we currently live in Durham, North Carolina. The Research Triangle is here. It's actually a really hot place to get jobs. She could have looked around for a job to work at locally at a physical location, right?
But it's not like she's not doing what she wants to do, correct?
I'm trying to be nice here, Paul. You're trying to get me into hot water with my wife.
No, I'm saying that you're saying she sacrificed. And I'm saying, how did she sacrifice? Because she's doing science every day. She's working from home. Where is the sacrifice?
Well, I think initially, you know, she could have, the sacrifice was focusing more on telecommuting, working from home jobs, where when you're initially looking for jobs and you have no idea what you want to do.
Yeah, right.
It's sometimes easier to be like, oh, let me drive down to the office and talk to the boss and interview there, sorts of things.
Or even, you know, you get a faculty position somewhere, and that limits where she can get a job as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's still a two-body problem, but she just wasn't interested in the faculty side of things.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So how is the job finding process? How is the job search process? Painful? How many different talks did you give, interviews? You're going to say one.
One.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, but that's not, I don't think that's, so there's a way to categorize sort of people on the job market. There's the upper, I will readily admit I'm not the upper echelon.
Okay.
And the upper echelon person, you know, the less than one percenters are the people who go around and do the circuits and they're wooed by multiple schools.
Yeah.
Most people are not wooed by multiple schools. And I would put myself into that category. I certainly applied to a lot of places, but you know, you don't hear anything back for the most part. There's sort of, you know, these informal check-ins once in a while where someone might email you back or a little Skype interview that's not an interview sorts of things. But, you know, it's probably not a coincidence that I'm hired in a place where people knew me, right?
Sure. I just had this discussion with someone else that I asked them what they used to believe that they now think is naive. And they had the belief that science is different than the rest of the world in that people have good intentions and you get by on your merit, you advance on your merit, and it's not about politics or who you know.
Yeah.
But that myth was dispelled in his experience.
Yeah, I think that's pretty naive. I mean, that's naive. It would be nice if things were that way. And I don't think it's the other extreme where I know people complain like, oh, it's all politics. And yeah, it's certainly politics, but you know, science is done by humans, and humans have some habits, right? And that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So
you had a pretty untumultuous job search experience.
For the exact pit position or just overall?
Overall, because there's the idea of like when you start to consider, oh, is it time now to look for a faculty position? And then at some point you have to start.
Yeah, no, it's totally horrible. It's horrible. I don't want to, you should
That's
not say that.
That's what
I was
trying to get out of you.
yeah. No, you should not say it's untumultuous. It's terrible. It's literally, and I remember this when we were grad students. I remember postdocs at Pitt, you know, I actively saw them change their personality and like get depressed and watch their soul like be crushed over the course of months.
Yeah.
And I went through the same process. I think of like the Bugs Bunny cartoons when we were young that I used to watch where like you fall off the cliff and they're like hanging by 10 fingers and then it's like 9 fingers. Yeah. And you know, people are jumping off at 9 fingers and 8 fingers. And for what it's worth, people who stick around to the 1 and 2 fingers, if you can stick around for that long and, you know, keep your mental health in check, sometimes the opportunities come up. And so I was not at all like, oh, I'm definitely getting a faculty position. It's always been a completely impossible, unrealistic thing that I wanted to do. And so I looked at many other jobs. You know, I looked outside of academia because it was getting time to leave my postdoc.
Is that something that you just felt, that it was getting time to leave your postdoc? Or did you, how did you make the decision?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of know in general how many years you've been in the lab and how that looks on paper, sort of thing, right? And it's, so I should say to the audience, I did two postdocs. Right. And that I've even had people say to me, like, to be shocked that I was doing a second postdoc and think that that's already the kiss of death.
It's like standard now almost.
Well, I think in, you know, for awake behaving animal work, it's okay. But, you know, there are people in other, you know, cell molecular labs that are like, why would you ever do that? Like, how do you expect to get a position after that? You know, I think you just sort of blow those people off.
I didn't appreciate going in also. I mean, there was always the sense that, well, you're always taught that papers come a little more slowly from awake behaving monkey neurophysiology studies. And man, is that true.
Yeah.
In my experience. So you could, you know, I did a, I guess a 6-year postdoc, and I think I only got like 2 publications out of it. And there'll be more down the road, you know, as the data continue to be analyzed and stuff. But it's kind of embarrassing on the, it looks bad on the CV compared to someone who, you know, comes from psychology and their CV is 6 pages long with just tons and tons of papers.
Yeah. And I think all that stuff is absolutely true. So when you're going up for that, when you're interviewing or interested in the position, you're competing against other people who have different subgenres of, you know, their research, like let's say EEG again, just because that's what you brought up before. Yeah. Those people are cranking out papers and you're not. And an astute search committee will be aware of those things. But I would say on average, most search committees are not astute. You know, it's hard to be in touch with every single detail, and they have other responsibilities in their lives. And
even if you are astute, there's still bias to prefer a longer CV.
Sure. You see a big sheet of paper. I mean, this gets back to just humans doing science, right?
Yeah.
They're humans. You look at a big sheet of paper with lots of lines versus a few lines.
How's your imposter syndrome? Are you, because that's something
it's strong.
That you know, people can kind of hide in graduate school and even, you know, a postdoc, I would say. But when you bear the responsibility of running your own lab, I think, I wonder if the imposter syndrome creeps up a little bit more.
Yeah, for sure. My imposter syndrome is I wouldn't, it's not rampant.
I should say, I'll just say that I think you have one of the healthier dose of self-awareness than most people at least admit, at least, you know, externally, you will at least admit it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I don't feel like I'm an imposter. I'll just reticently acknowledge, you know, like, oh no, I'm a failure.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not trying to be anything else. What did you think I was?
I found that's a really good way to shortcut the entire thing is just reduce everyone's expectations.
Well, I do, you know, I've been doing neuroscience for over 15 years now.
Right.
And, you know, I should say my very first job was as a technician in Jim DiCarlo's lab at MIT. He was a new faculty member. So just to fill people in, he was a new faculty member at the time, just hired at MIT. He's now the chair of the department.
Yeah.
And, you know, pretty wildly successful. But I remember sitting there. So that's always been like this is the person who does neuroscience, right? That was my sort of first introduction to neuroscience proper, especially for my field.
Let me just interject because DiCarlo has done the seminal work that we often talk about on the show, bringing deep learning networks into the ventral visual stream in neuroscience, comparing the deep learning networks with brains and having wild success with that. He really started that. And I think that that's the wild success that you're really referring to.
Yeah. Well, so scientifically, yes. And, you know, even within the department, right, like most, it's unlikely that you would be hired into the up and coming chair of the department's lab.
Right.
Right. Like, what are the chances? I mean, for MIT, especially for those like in the know, you know, what are the chances that you even get hired into somebody who's not going to get kicked out 5 years later? Right.
Right.
I mean, like some people don't get tenure. So, you know, I was sort of like around these wildly successful, incredibly smart people. And even from that point, I was like, I will never be this. Right. Like,
right.
Like I need to start 30 years ago in order to catch up. So I've been aware of my shortcomings, but also I'm aware of my strengths too. And I think that's just that's the important part of dealing with the imposter syndrome. And as you said, like, I'll acknowledge where I fall short.
I mean, I consider that a strength of your personality, but
thanks, Paul.
I'm not sure if it's a really advantageous aspect career-wise.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, in terms of selling yourself, right, there's a bit of a, you need to sort of inflate yourself a bit more. And
yeah,
I could probably use some improvement in that department, but so it goes.
Speaking of famous labs, for someone who has a choice of what lab to join, I mean, would you ever, if you had the choice, join someone's lab who wasn't famous or wasn't really well known, given that knowing people still is maybe the most important thing in science and advancing your career? Would you join someone's lab who is just starting their career?
Well, we did join the lab.
I know. And now people have to join your lab to start their career,
I know,
too.
I know. I have pretty strong feelings about this. Not that I think I'm necessarily, well, I guess I do think I'm right. That's why I'm going to say it. But I think the answer to that question depends on the stage of your training. I think it is perfectly acceptable, if not great, to join a junior faculty member's lab as a graduate student and possibly as a postdoc. But as a graduate student, when you're new and you just need to learn things, all you want to do is have someone who can support you.
Yeah.
And for the most part, I think it's much better as a grad student if you can have someone come into the lab and sit next to you and still do the experiments.
Which was what we had.
Which is exactly what we had, Paul. And I know. And I, you know, that wasn't always fun at the moment, right? Like when you're doing your experiment and you're like, get away from me, PI. Like, I know what I'm doing, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But in retrospect, the alternative is, you know, someone who's, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, 80 years old and hasn't been in the lab for 30 years. And you want to ask them, oh, this is broken, or how do I do this? And they point you to somebody else.
Or they just have 600 graduate students. And so there's really no central executive figure.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not just a learning technical skills. That there's an emotional support to that, too. You know, having someone who actually can relate to the experiment that you're doing, as opposed to just saying, hey, go do this thing. I read about that people are doing this for the past 5 years. Why can't you do it? Sort of thing.
Right.
I think as you become a postdoc and you're looking to get on the job market, there's a definite advantage to coming out of more famous, well-established, popular labs. And that's again, not necessarily a negative, like, oh, it's all politics thing. It's sometimes those popular labs have produced people who are successful. And, you know, if you want to go into a lab and you want to demonstrate that you can be successful, one way to do that is to say that you went to a lab that has trained people to be successful and learned the skills that you need to be successful. So,
what would you do differently? Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, end rant.
What would you do differently if you started over? Is there something that you regret having done? Are you happy with, I mean, everyone's path is different and...
I'm pretty happy. I mean, I don't know how you can ever figure that out, right? Like, for all the bad situations or things that didn't work out. So another, I'll do a fill in the listeners thing. RPI left our university when we were graduate students, right?
Yeah.
And that was not ideal. You know, I was in the middle of a project and suddenly here's a deadline. June 1st, you must stop recording by June 1st. And, you know, we were given plenty of advance notice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're a little bit stressed about, oh man, I just invested 3 years into this. And now I really need to make sure I finish it within X amount of time. And if not, what is supposed to happen, right?
I was offered to go too with him. So he was, so Mark had his own two body problem to deal with because his wife is a well-known scientist as well. And so I was given the option to go with him. I think I had maybe one more year-ish.
Yeah.
I can't even remember how long I stayed after he left.
I think we were all offered to go. I literally just bought a house in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Like 6 months previous to that. And I was like, this is bad timing for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like that don't work out. But in retrospect, I can't say that was a mistake. And I think you learn a lot from those situations. It's really stressful. I've been in stressful situations similar to that afterwards. And you start to learn, this is going to sound terrible because if someone ever told me this, I would tell them to be quiet. But, you know, things are going to be okay. But that's the truth. Things will work themselves out if you apply yourself and get your data. You'll figure out a good solution if you're surrounded by reasonably helpful people.
I mean, is it important just to keep your head down and keep moving forward? Or what's the important lesson? Because things won't be okay unless you're active in that process.
Yeah. Yeah, you certainly. Yeah. So I'm a firm believer of the keep the head down. You know, it's my blue collar upbringing. You have to do the work. The data's not going to come in by itself, right? This is not You can't sit and do nothing. And you need to make an attempt. You know, lots of science of what we do is failure. And that's failure on an individual daily basis. That's failure over the course of, you know, doing a 3-year project that you submit and gets rejected. All those things are failures. So lots of times that means you have to try a lot.
Do you have a favorite example in your own past of a failure that has helped shape you or brought you near scientific death? Often I'll ask people, and it's all about the grant, not getting a paper published. And those are sort of those are the normal failures.
Yeah. I went into neuroscience knowing about those things and expecting those things. And, you know, maybe again, talking about my personality, I expect to fail to some extent. I'm not, you know.
You almost guarantee it to yourself that.
Yeah. No. I mean, I wrote profanities on the cover of my manuscript, so I don't know why I got rejected.
Yeah.
I don't think failures are the things that I've learned from. I think the stressful situations in the lab, like I was talking about, you know, our Mark leaving as your PIs, the lab is shutting down. I think those are the situations where I've learned the most. You sort of learn to reach out to other people. You learn to have some faith in yourself. You learn to figure out other ways you can do science aside from the one specific way that you had in mind when you first started. You know, or address another question that's also interesting that may not be the ultimate grand total question that you started with, but is a valuable contribution. So those sorts of things, which I think, you know, those are all really important scientific skills. They're not just coping mechanisms for getting through your stressful situation.
This is going back to when people start with wide-eyed, high expectations and the big questions, and then those big questions lead to you realize how little we know about the things underlying those big questions. And then that leads to a little bit smaller questions, but still super important. And then you realize we really don't understand any of that. And it keeps going and going, and it's turtles all the way down. How different now is your attitude about the scientific questions? Do you even think about the larger, more wondrous questions now? Or are you super focused on the detail-oriented, specific questions we can actually make progress on?
Yeah, I think I never really started out with the I want to understand love question or consciousness, you know.
When we were at the conference of love, we figured that out, right?
Right.
The love conference.
Yes. We probably shouldn't talk about that on air. It's not.
Well, okay. Yeah.
The consciousness was just sort of an offshoot of, you know, thinking about visual perception, and my undergraduate training was in cognitive science.
It doesn't have to be consciousness. You have these. You could say attention, for instance, or what, you know, because you've studied attention, time perception is a big one that you've studied. And these are big questions that we don't necessarily know the answers to the questions that underlie those bigger questions. So,
yeah, I think I've learned to focus on tractable questions.
Okay.
And so I actually think maybe this will be surprising. I don't know. Maybe not. I actually think attention is more tractable than time perception. And that's just learning through experience of my research. At the time, you know, I thought the time perception work that I did in graduate school was pretty straightforward. But, you know, the more you think about it, the more you figure out that time is correlated with every single variable, of course.
Isn't attention also?
No, attention is definitely not.
Okay, well, let's not go down the attention road, because that's kind of
sure.
We've been talking about on the podcast recently, whether attention is even a thing. And you offline reminded me that I had brought you up in a previous episode way back when, I guess, at something that you said during a journal club asking, do we even know what attention is? And I don't know if that's changed in your head.
Yeah, definitely. I think attention. So again, just to fill people in, I did my first postdoc in John Mansell's lab. If you want, I would say, if you want to start to understand attention and have a firm footing for understanding it, you should read his papers.
Ah, okay.
That's my personal and completely biased perspective.
But are you talking about attention as one thing?
Nope. Okay. And so, you know, in this past, actually, he has a PNAS paper in the past year about essentially breaking down attention into its subcomponents, you know, readily acknowledging that it's mixed up when the way people use it in the literature, you know, we can only do so much as individuals, which is to say, here, we've operationally defined it in every paper that we've published, and here's what we mean when we say this. I think the example that he brings up, if I'm if I'm remembering that paper correctly, or maybe this is one of his talks, is bringing up the example of memory, which formerly was like, oh, memory research. And well, you know, there's all types of memory, right? And now the field of studying memory has actually been broken down into fear extinction, right? Like fear extinction is a very particular type of memory. I know the high profile papers will say whatever, memory replay, right? But getting shocked in the foot is a bit of a different memory than, you know, running through a field of grass and flowers as you and I did at the Love Conference.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, words like memory and attention, they are supposed to map onto systems in the brain. And then we realize we don't even...
Are they?
Oh, yeah. They're supposed to be like an attentional system. And then, you know, you have your memory, different memory areas of the brain doing different types of memory, you know. So...
Yeah.
We would like them to, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. You if you want to continue rant about attention, go for it.
My brief rant is attention research, I fully agree. If you just pull out 20 or 100 attention papers, it's a mess. I do think that's not a reason to give up on it and dismiss all of it. I think there are people doing really, really excellent, extremely thoughtful, well-controlled experiments. And if you take the time to seek those out, it will help you get a firm grasp on, you know, the subtopics of attention, what they are, and how to interpret other people's results as well. That's my shortest summary.
What's one of your favorite scientific moments from your life thus far? Can I guess? And then
you can guess because I don't know the answer, and yeah. Then I can tell you.
Listening to a neuron burst before a saccade, the first time you sort of witness that, you know, there's a monkey in the next room. You're hearing the popping of the neuron, and you hear pop, 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 and then the whoosh, and then you are watching its eye movements and can see an eye movement happen.
Yeah, that's a good one, actually. I wasn't even thinking along those lines, but that has to be. I mean, this is something I say to trainees, you know, either whatever, master students or grad students trying to figure out what they want to do, you know, rotation students. Oh, should I stay in this lab? Right. If you don't like that, if you don't find that exciting, then you should go to another lab, because that is the, and I think that's true for most people in our field, you know, that's the exciting, enriching, amazing thing, which is just watching that happen in real time. And still, I mean, you know, to this day, that's the thing that blows my mind. And that's the thing that makes me excited to figure out what's going on. Maybe not, well, certainly eye movements as we did in graduate school. I recorded in Area MT now most recently, you know, just a motion patch,
yeah.
Which given what you and I saw in graduate school and prefrontal cortex, you know, blows that out of the water, right? You just turn on this patch and it's like,
yeah. Now you're doing what all the cool kids are doing with the MT.
Well, that's why people get excited about those things, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's definitely one. In terms of experiences, I think I was very fortunate to join John Mansell's lab. That was my top choice. You know, when Mark Sommer, our advisor, sat me down for the end of our graduate training and was like, so what do you want to do for a postdoc? Or where do you want to go? And I said, oh, well, John Mansell's lab, but I don't know why he would ever have me in his lab, right? These sorts of dismissive things.
Right.
My training in his lab and the research in that lab was excellent. I think I could have and should have taken advantage of it more, but you know, things happen in life, like you have children and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But that's been a big part.
Did Mark help you get that job, or was he just citing a time that he was just asking what was going on?
No, I think I'm just citing the time where I think he encouraged me. I would have never applied had he not encouraged me to just be like, oh, well, send him an email, ask him what's up, as you know, those sorts of things. I don't think he did much beyond that, but I don't know.
Mark didn't discourage me, but I almost quit after, you know, getting my PhD. I wasn't going to go do a postdoc, and it was one of my PhD dissertation committee members who sat me down, actually asked for a meeting with me and sat me down and told me that I needed to go do a postdoc and so I wouldn't slip through the cracks. I'm not sure how I feel about that still today.
Yeah, it's always a strange thing to sort of push people along a path, right, that may or may not be the right. Like if the person's not choosing the path themselves or they're uncertain about it, is that the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think she just helped encourage me. I'm not, you know, she didn't push me down the path. I had to make a decision.
Yeah,
but
yeah, and she certainly did it out of good intentions, right?
Yeah, she did. Anything else that you think people should know about you know, the process.
The getting a faculty position process?
Yeah, I guess just the whole arc of, because it's almost like, so you have this vision, right, when you start. The goal is tenure, eventual tenure. Yeah. And it's a long road.
Which is not, by the way, you know, so this is something you learn along the way. That's not actually that special. Like, you can have tenure and the department can still just squeeze the living daylights out of your resources and make your life miserable. So it's not like anything magical that you have some job that you have tenure, but it's terrible, right? Like, that's not, it's not the end all be all. Like, oh, I finally made it. Here, I have a closet to do my research in.
But you do kind of see that as an end point.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, what you're saying is that is not an end point.
I'm saying as you like go along, even that changes, right? Even like the dream job is like, oh, it's actually not even that great. So what is all of this for?
What about, you know, I get emails from people asking for advice and they often have a pretty specific description of what they're interested in and the kind of lab that they need to join, very specific. And my immediate thought is it almost doesn't matter, like what you, how you start.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that goes back to what I was saying before about training with a, you know, junior faculty or a senior faculty. If you're a graduate student, go into a lab and publish papers. They don't need to be high profile. They don't need to be anything. Just show that you're competent and you can show up every day and do work. When you're a postdoc, then yes, start formulating your special magical take on the whole entire world and maybe try to get your higher profile papers out. But certainly as a graduate student or that level, just learn basic skills. And, you know, you and I both know plenty of graduate students, everyone does, who are not really competent, right? Yeah, I'm looking at you.
My
I'm
hand is
directly.
Raised, yeah.
No, I know. We tried to kick you out of the lab, Paul, but you just kept coming back.
Yeah, I had good lawyers.
So, I don't know. I don't know if that helps or hurts people. I agree that being overly specific or being focused on one single subtopic is... seems like it doesn't usually help you.
You know what else helps is to be surrounded by other good graduate students. I guess I'm not sure if I've ever formally thanked you, but thank you because you helped train me as a graduate student. You were 1 year before me. I mean, my intellect far exceeds yours, but
no, I know
you had a little bit more experience. And so,
wait, hold on.
Sort of...
Can you speak more slowly? I'm just trying to follow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What do you think? Does that wrap up the? You haven't shed any tears yet, so. Maybe
I don't. I got a faculty job. I have nothing to shed tears on quite yet.
How's it feel? How did it feel to get to know that you had a faculty job?
You're getting close to shedding tears now, Paul. That's true.
Yeah.
It was huge. It was absolutely immensely huge, even because I went into the interview not expecting success. You know, you have no reason to go in and be like, oh, I'm going to nail this and just take this job home.
That's also your MO, is going into everything not expecting
a good outcome. I guess so. Yeah. I guess so. But, you know, well, just even like, you know, my background knowledge of the interview process and where they were at and all these different things, you know, I went into it very much thinking this is an opportunity to practice interviewing, right? Because it was essentially my first full faculty job interview. And it's like, if it goes horribly wrong, which it probably will, you know, they're going to ask me some question about, oh, after 1.5 years, tell me what your budget will be on, you know, and I'll be like, oh, I didn't think about that.
What's your five-year vision, five-year plan and stuff like that? But so was it more relief or joy or, you know, was it like a burden that you'd been carrying that felt like was finally released or what other words could I put in your mouth?
No, joy. Certainly joy. It was not, well, I mean, the burden insofar as there's always the personal burden of, you know, I have a wife and kids, like I need to have a job. And so... I was looking to go to industry possibly because that's, you know, what else can you do?
I've never met your kids, but I have always felt Amanda was, I've always considered her a burden.
Yeah. No, insofar as my kids are genetically related to me, they're actually an even larger burden, if you can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the, you know, it's very rare to work hard for something for 10 years, more than that, and then succeed.
What do you mean?
Well, since if you asked me in graduate school, what do I want to do? I would say, I want to run my own lab.
Yeah.
Like, I'm interested in neuroscience. I think about these things. I have questions that I want to answer that nobody else is answering, and it frustrates me. I want to be the one to do it. And then you say, oh, okay. Well, Patrick, talk to me in 10 years, right? And like, through that 10 years, like, you have children.
Everything changes.
Like, you have failed experiments, you know, whatever. You move around the country, like, all these different things happen. And getting a faculty position from the beginning is just a low probability thing. So how could this ever come? And I should say, So you asked me if there's one thing I should say or anything else I wanted to say. Luck is a huge, huge part of all of this, and there's no getting around that.
But fortune favors the prepared mind.
Yes, to some extent. But, you know, you're never going to get a faculty position if there's not a spot open for you that fits you. And you're not in control of what a department is looking for at a given period of time.
I think that was when we were graduate students, some of the postdocs, I don't think the job market was very favorable at the time. And that was a huge stressor as well, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how it is now.
No, it's equally as crazy. Like, you know, there could be, let's say, 10 open positions in the whole entire country, or let's say the whole entire continent. Let's say North America. We'll throw in Canada.
Eh.
A. Yeah. Thank you. And, you know, but how many of those positions are actually fit your particular needs? Like, and how do you fit the department that's currently there?
Yeah.
You're basically never going to fit. It's statistically unlikely. And so fit is a big part of it. And that just comes down to luck. You know, this year, I suppose, I mean, think about the pandemic that we're in right now. If I'm applying, I have friends, right, who are applying for jobs this year as opposed to last year. And guess what? The universities are not going to be hiring for another year or two or more.
I keep seeing little celebrations on Twitter. You're not on Twitter, are you?
I am on Twitter.
Oh, you are? I didn't know that.
I just tweeted up about a month ago. Mayo_lab, everybody. Catch me on Twitter. I've tweeted once.
I'll put it in the notes too. I'll find you. Anyway, I keep seeing people tweeting about getting a new job. And I think, man, it seems like a lot of new jobs are being nailed down right now. In the pandemic.
I think people are, well, that's because things are already budgeted for and they're squeezing in their last positions.
Yeah.
Next year, there will not, you know, this,
yeah,
that's right. These are things that have been in the works for 2 or 3 years and, you know, universities have to budget for the years, but there will, I mean, I already know every university that I'm currently working for, affiliated with, right? Duke and moving up to Pittsburgh, they've already sent out emails that it's a hiring freeze.
You lucky bastard.
Well, it is. Luck is exactly, it's luck, everybody.
How close are we to understanding the brain, and how has your conception of that changed over time?
Yeah, I'll nitpick and say, you know, it depends what you mean by understanding, right?
Sure. Like, sure.
If I talk to my parents about this is what we understand about the brain, they think that's understanding, right? Like I say, oh, there's these neurons, this part of the brain that fire when we do XYZ, and they think that's pretty cool, and that's a level of understanding. Of course, the level of understanding that you're probably referring to, and anyone who has a neuro interest, is more along the lines of understanding individual neurons, right? And cell types and how those different cell types modulate activity and how the network functions as you insert or take out different cell types. I think we're very far away from that, but I'm not sure. Well, that would be great to understand at that level. I'm not sure it matters. It depends what your ultimate goal is. If your goal is to help people or to help understand brain diseases and disorders, you might just need a functional account of neuronal activity.
Do you think that we're much closer now than when you started?
Before I started or you started?
When you started. Well, what's the difference?
Well, your contributions have been a little bit more significant than mine, is all I'm saying.
A little bit? Come on, man.
Okay. Well, I was just trying to be nice. Yeah, I think we've come pretty far. I know, you know, the current there's a few trends, a few very, very cool popular things going on.
We need more theory
by somebody who's not me, presumably. You know, in systems neuroscience now, with the multiple neuron recordings, there's a lot of the dimensionality reduction sort of looking at neuronal manifolds and these sorts of things. Regardless of your perspective on whether we've learned something from that about how the brain works, I think that change in perspective has been really useful to get people thinking in somewhat new and different ways that will help propel things forward. And, you know, just the simple addition of recording from multiple neurons in awake behaving animals simultaneously, as opposed to recording from them serially.
Yeah, yeah. And then doing analyses as if they were recorded simultaneously.
Exactly.
That's my favorite. Yeah.
Yeah, and pretending like the behavior and, you know, let's say the animal's state of attention is exactly the same at all those times.
There you go again about attention.
That's a big deal. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm just trying to be an optimist because I need to be.
If you turn out to be an optimist, if this has changed you into an optimist, I don't know what I'm going to do.
I know. Well, in this small regard, I do think, you know, neuroscience is my religion to some extent. Not a very religious person, but this is how I find meaning in my life and define things. So I need to, I'm not saying like what I do is the end all be all of anything, but if I can make some small contribution to human knowledge, and by small, I mean absolutely tiny, infinitesimal, and possibly buried under, you know, thousands of papers in the annals of science, I might have a low standard for what our lives should be, but that's a contribution that will live beyond me, aside from my children.
When I knew I was leaving academia, I told one of our colleagues from our graduate school days, and he looked me in the eye and said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something to the effect of, well, you've made your mark in science. You have fundamentally contributed. I thought, no, that's like the most minuscule mark ever. Like, why?
Well, but think of, so the vast majority of the population, what mark have they made?
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it all depends on what you value and want to get out of life.
What are your thoughts on deep learning? Is that going to help us solve the brain?
No.
So this most recent deep learning explosion revolution is just another incremental step?
Will it help us solve the brain? Yeah, it's tough for me to say. So my personal take, my personal take is I'm not an expert in that. And certainly if you look through the history of neuroscience, people were super excited about back propagation and connectionist networks. And, you know, there's plenty of papers, and this is how we're going to solve the brain. This is what the brain does. Look at all these things it can do.
It's hard for me to remember how I felt about that stuff because I was not well versed in connectionism, but I knew it existed. It was there, but it seemed tangentially related to the to what we were doing.
Well, so when I was, this was my undergraduate, you know, like I said, I was a cognitive science major. We had a full, you know, course on artificial neural networks. And, you know, that was in the 90s. And it was back propagation is going to solve everything. This is what the brain is doing. I never found it that compelling. And, you know, it's the same story being played out now, but on faster computers and more sophisticated things. So that's my cynical perspective. And I think like any tool, it's a tool that needs to be used well and, you know, with some deep understanding, not to use a play on words with deep learning. But on the other hand, going back to people like Jim DiCarlo, he has thought immensely and deeply about these things, and I completely trust his intuitions and insights. So, I should say the first graduate student in Jim DiCarlo's lab was David Cox, who then went on to be junior faculty at Harvard and is now, I think, the director of the Watson Lab at IBM. So, you know, these people are orders of magnitude more involved and more knowledgeable about these things, and they're producing really insightful papers. So whether it will actually solve the brain, I think it will be one other tool that will help us understand the brain.
What about solve? Maybe intelligence is a better word than the brain.
For me personally, we need more information about the basic physiology. And that's not going to be solved by deep learning. That's going to be solved by recording from the brain.
So there's one question of whether substrate matters, right? Do you need a brain to have an intelligent system? That's a different question than will understanding the brain generate necessary knowledge to build whatever intelligent system, whether it depends on having a brain or not.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your take is on that latter question.
Yeah, I think the latter question, you know, these levels of understanding, right? If you want to understand intelligence at an algorithmic level, then you should be able to put it onto any substrate that you want. And I think that's Jim DiCarlo's perspective. At least it was, whatever, 15 years ago. So I should say my cognitive science thesis was essentially, the title was something like, can there ever be human-level artificial intelligence?
Okay.
And so as soon as Jim found that out, he was like, and of course, let me say, I was the only person in the lab at the time. There were no other grad students. There were no postdocs.
You're a technician.
I was a technician. So it was just Jim and I every day for like 6 months to a year putting together the lab. And this is a guy who like thinks about the brain and wants to talk about the brain every day with an undergraduate, with an undergraduate liberal arts student. He was just, you know, would try to talk to me every day. Like, well, what did you think? What I read about your thesis, you know, what was the outcome? And at the time, my thesis basically concluded, no, we would never get to that level. Which, yeah. You know, in retrospect, I don't know. You know, I just read the literature and that was my best interpretation of the time. But he was always harping on me about, you know, well, why couldn't you, why, if it's just a substrate and you move from some carbon-based sloppy stuff in the brain, why can't you move to this other stuff based on electronics? And I don't know. I think there's lots of exciting things coming out of that field. And I look particularly at the work that I've of people that I'm familiar with, mm-hmm. but I'm not an expert. I don't know what to say about it.
Do you think that we're asking the right questions yet?
In deep learning generally or neuroscience generally?
In, I'm going to say in intelligence. So that encompasses both.
Intelligence. I think in general, probably most of the field is not, and some of the field is, and it's just a matter of separating the good from the bad.
So there are right questions being asked.
Yeah.
We're pointed in the right direction. As like a whole field, as humanity to understand.
Well, I think if, you know, there's a singular direction, I think we're moving in a haphazard way towards that direction, right, is the right way to think about it. Okay. Again, science is sloppy and messy and it's humans and we don't know the right direction to begin with. But I think overall, I'm not so discouraged that we're moving opposite to the correct direction.
So you're not super excited about this recent deep learning craze. But even outside of that, people often talk about there being, you know, we haven't seen the Einstein of neuroscience yet, and we're awaiting this sort of breakthrough moment. Do you think that there will be a breakthrough and that will, you know, fundamentally give a step change to our understanding, or is it going to be just an incremental march?
Yeah, I think this is not entirely my own idea and I don't know where it came from, but I've certainly heard neuroscience compared to genetics, right? Before we understood the genetic code.
Yes, before DNA, yeah.
Yeah, so this is the same way, right? And so we know that there's a language of the brain and we know that, you know, something like spiking activity is what is the currency of the language of the brain, but we don't really understand the details of that yet. And I see my work as, you know, the basic research that's contributing to that type of research endeavor. I'm not sure when it will happen, but I do think we're waiting for that sort of breakthrough where, you know, well, I can't tell you what it is right now because I don't know the answer. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you. But, you know, whatever, you know, oh, the brain works this way when we're doing X, but the brain works this way when we're doing Y. Something like that, that is an insight that will give us a comprehensive understanding of previous literature and help push things forward. I think that's still yet to come.
How are people going to look back on this period in neuroscience? Let's say 100 years from now, are we going to look like barbarians? Are we going to, are they going to appreciate the work that we did? I say we as if I'm doing it.
Yeah. Are they going to appreciate? Yeah. I mean, you know,
is this the golden age of neuroscience right now? Are we there yet? Or like you're just saying, is it a pre-DNA sort of pre-Kuhnian?
I think more Bronze Age is probably something like that is more appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we don't, in retrospect, you're always going to look back at science as you should, as not progressing to where you are now. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to think we've reached the pinnacle if we don't have the answers to the questions. So, you know, I think we're futzing around and doing our best. As you know, neuroscience is a relatively new field in terms of scientific study. We're only decades into it, which is crazy.
It
right?
is.
Like,
yeah.
So the fact that we probably know anything or can do anything is sort of impressive in its own right. I mean, if you think about, let's say, my subgenre of field of vision and eye movements and ocular motor research, that started in the 70s, right? 60s, 70s. We're being charitable to the 60s, but the 70s. And even then it was some papers drawn by some guys with some figures where they're like, hey, check this out. It's pretty cool.
Hand-drawn.
Yeah, exactly. So to come from there to here seems like pretty good progress, but definitely lots more to go.
Is it better to ask really big questions and try to chip away at them, or is it better to focus in on really smaller, tractable? I slipped tractable in there because I know you like that word, so that's going to bias your answer.
Yes. No. Well, if you're doing science in a lab, you need to come up with answers to questions. And those questions can't be big and broad because you're not going to be able to answer them with, at least with, you know, the techniques that I'm currently doing in my lab, those sorts of things. And most people are doing. So you need to break down your larger question into smaller questions is my perspective on doing science.
What do you think one of the main misconceptions is that people have when they're wanting to get into neuroscience? What's something that people learn along the way that they were wrong about?
Yeah, I think like you said before, I want to understand love. So let me go join this lab that studies some neurotransmitter, right? And I'm going to figure it out. Science is the like...
Well, sorry, what's the misconception that they're going to figure it out?
The misconception is that you're actually going to answer the question.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Damn, that's rough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's science is a long slog. It is the eternal slog.
Yeah. It's almost a misconception that you're even going to come close to answering the question. However, you will answer questions and that's part of the fun.
Yeah. And hopefully you're answering questions that are still related, right? That you actually now appreciate the larger topic is actually not so simple as what is love, right? Or what is consciousness? And that's cool. Like you should be excited by that, hopefully.
Yeah. I guess internally you can be motivated by those big amorphous questions. As long as externally you're answering the tractable ones.
Every once in a while you can talk to people on podcasts about them.
Ironically, I'm probably doing much more good for society through this podcast than I ever would have in science. So
I completely agree.
What's a popular idea that you think is wrong?
Yeah. The dorsal ventral stream idea, which has some explanatory power, I really would just like to not hear about it ever again.
The where idea or the how
idea? That there's these two segregated pathways in cortex. Mm-hmm. There is some segregation, but you know, you look at the anatomy, look at the classic Fellman and Van Essen subway map of how these brain areas are connected. It doesn't do us, I don't think we're helping ourselves by overstating the dorsal versus ventral pathways. I think in fact, we would be much better served by talking about that idea in neuroscience 101 class and then showing a picture, which is like, hey, look, there's a whole bunch of connections between all of these brain areas, and we don't really know much about it so far.
You know what's really crazy? Neuroscience is so young, we still don't even know the full anatomy. I mean, we're finding out new connections all the time, and that's a very fundamental thing we don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing I always think about, which is when you're in the lab and you're inserting an electrode into the brain, you're like, oh, go here. Oh, don't go over there.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know what's over there.
1 millimeter.
Yeah, exactly. Like this other thing. But it's actually cool that, you know, there's Rich Krauss's lab has recent papers, you know, out about, I shouldn't say new brain areas, but, you know, doing imaging to find other brain areas related to attention. And I think that sort of stuff is extremely valuable instead of limiting ourselves to these 2 or 3 or 5 or 6 brain areas that are well studied. So obviously it makes it easier to study them more, but clearly there's other parts of the brain contributing. And it's a matter of putting those networks together. I think that's going to be maybe the next step of our understanding in neuroscience.
It's all about hippocampus these days. I guess it always has been.
I don't know. I forget.
Yeah. Well, you're not really up to date on modern neuroscience, so you can be forgiven for that.
That's true.
Did you have kids at the right time?
Well, that's you know that the answer to that question is that there's never a right time, which is what everyone tells you before you have kids.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully. I tried to tell you, but I don't know if you listened or not. You just have to... If you want to have children, then you have to have children. If you want to be the kind of person who plans your entire life, and I should say again, if you're wildly successful and you already have your Nature and your Science paper as a graduate student, then yes, write down on your calendar the day that you want to have. Right.
Yeah.
That will work out for you. For the rest of us, it will not work out that way. And I think I basically had one child per postdoc, which is not ideal.
Yeah.
Right. So in my first, basically within my first 2 years of each postdoc, we had my first son and my second son. And that's somewhat terrible when you're trying to like reorient yourself to a new field, learn new things. You know, for those who haven't gone on to do a postdoc, when you are a grad student, you feel like an expert in some thing, but then you go to do your postdoc and suddenly you feel like you know nothing. And, you know, why have you been ignoring this whole topic for this so long? So,
what people also don't understand, people without children, is that having two kids actually is twice as hard as having one kid, at least in the beginning, which is, you wouldn't think that it would work like that. But
no, I think it's actually, it's a minimum of at least twice.
Yeah, there's a multiplicative
And it's factor. Crazy.
Yeah. Patrick, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks for talking with me, man.
Of course, Paul. I'm happy to talk with you. If anybody has questions, they can always reach out to me, too.
On Twitter.
On Twitter, you know, I'm on the internet somewhere. I'm sure you can find me.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time.